Okay. So, welcome back after the break. Let me remind you where we were. So, we defined the space of so-called core diagrams. Really, it was the dual to the top derivatives of finite type invariants, and the top derivatives kind of are, well, if you understand the top derivatives, you understand everything inductively. So, so really, this is the space we really, really want to understand. And it came out to be the space of core diagrams. Well, up until now, I've written core diagrams along within a circle, but here I'm using the long knot notation, and not theoretically, it corresponds to using long knots instead of round knots, but it's essentially the same. So, module with the 40 relation, which I will not repeat. And then, 2 weeks ago, we have proven the Brackett-Rise theorem, which says that the same space is isomorphic to the space you get if you allow internal trivalent vertices inside, above the skeleton, or inside the skeleton if you're using round skeleta. You also allow chords as before, but you also have these internal trivalent vertices. These internal trivalent vertices are oriented, so at every vertex, you specify one of the two possible cyclic orderings of the edges surrounding it. And the convention is that vertices are oriented counterclockwise unless otherwise noticed. So here we have two vertices that are oriented counterclockwise and one which is oriented clockwise. Modulo a different collection of relations, and they were the anti-symmetry relation, which says that if you have if you flip the orientation of an internal vertex, you flip a sign. The STU relation, which says that if you have a vertex on top of the skeleton, you can replace it by, well, the right-hand side. Okay. Maybe, though, I'm a bit unfair to this relation because it's the one that gives the theorem its name. Because really, you want to think of this as the bracket. And kind of if this is A and B, then this is the statement that a bracket B is equal to A times B, multiplying this way, times B minus B times A. Again, when you multiply along the skeleton, when you sort of multiply along the skeleton. Today, it will become clearer that this is really related to brackets. And the IHX relation, which says that, well, I is equal to H minus X. By the way, now that I mention it, I remember that last time I asserted that really you need only STU, and it implies the other two. And in fact, I've only proven STU. STU came about because I've only discussed STU. It came about because it was true by construction. I have more precisely, this space modulo STU. Okay, I've only used the STU relation in order to discuss the isomorphism with the thing with 4T. So the other two relations didn't at all come up. So I owe you a proof that the other two relations also hold. Okay? And I wasn't meaning to do it, but I guess I have to. Do I have to, or should I leave it as a homework assignment? I'll leave it as a homework assignment. Sorry, come to think of it, it's a great homework assignment. So this is homework. Okay. But it's easy. And sort of maybe the key point is that in this, when you come to proving the IHX relation, it becomes, well, under the same symbolism under which this is a bracket, this becomes, well, combining two brackets in three different ways, And that's the Jacobi identity. So this becomes Jacobi. Okay? But anyway, okay. Then I said, well, not quite the corollary of this, but within the proof of this, we've used one principle. Okay, one sort of hard thing. And the sort of hard thing, if you remember, the summation over hooks. Okay, which amounts to saying that, well, you know what, maybe I will not repeat the argument, but a consequence of that was that, in fact, the space for a long, for a skeleton which is a line, is isomorphic to the space where the skeleton is a circle. The reason is, well, the map from here to here is obvious. You just close the circle, the line into a circle. The map going the other way would have to be cutting open the circle. You have to show that it's independent of where you cut open. And moving the cut one notch amounts to taking one chord and sliding it from one end of the skeleton to the other end of the skeleton. And that was this summation over hooks thing. Okay? So this we have done. Okay? And the rest of the proposition is the first new statement for today. So the statement is that this space is a graded commutative algebra. Okay? Why? So graded we understand. Everything here was graded. So this we know. Commutative algebra, so algebra is also obvious. So if you want to multiply two chord diagrams, so this times that, I suppose I know that I can use trivalent vertices, so I may as well use them in the examples as well. By definition, will be equal to, you just concatenate the two diagrams. So you get a slightly longer diagram, which looks like this. So algebra we understand. And the only thing that remains is to show that it is commutative. So here are two ways to show that it is commutative. One way, had we been using the circle picture, clearly it wouldn't matter in which order we multiply. Right? So basically, suppose you have two diagrams whose built inside the skeleton, I want to multiply them. How would I do that? I would cut them open, each of them, then concatenate, then close again. But if I close again, there is clearly no ordering between the two components. So that's one way of saying it. And another way of saying it is to just repeatedly use this argument that allows us to take one chord from one end and bring it to the other end. Repeatedly use proof of commutativity. So we had this argument that allowed us, given anything made of diagram material, I mean, I'm not making any assertions about Swiss cheese. I mean, okay. So this is equal to this. So we can slide chords across clusters. So basically, if I wanted to switch the order of these two, I would first slide this chord, then I'd slide the next one, then I'd slide the next one, and then all three have been moved to the other side. Okay? So, theorem proven. I should say, before moving on, that this is a... immediate analog of a statement which is true for knots. Namely, the knottings of a line are isomorphic to the knottings of a circle, and both are, so this and that is a, well, graded doesn't make sense, algebra doesn't even make sense, because if we're just talking about knots, I mean, for algebra you need linears, a linear structure. So all I'll claim is that this is a commutative monoid. Monoid is a group with a unit, but without in sort of group, a non-group, with a multiplication which is associative, but without and a unit, but without without inverses. So and why is this true? Well, if you have a knot, if you have a long knot, you can close it, you get a circle knot. If you have a circle knot, you cut it open, and you have to show that it doesn't matter where you cut it open, but you show it. And the monoid structure, the multiplication, is by the obvious concatenation over here. And it's commutative for similar reasons. Okay? Okay.
Is that the connected sound number?
Right, so this is connected, the operation is really connected. Well, over here, if you view it this way, it's concatenation. If you view it as knotted circles, so if you wanted to take the product of one knot with another knot, and it will have to be the same one because there is only one knot that I know how to draw, namely the trefoil. So if you wanted to take the product of this with itself, you'd have to cut both of them open, concatenate, and, well, if you want the answer to land here, then you'd have to close back again. So what will it look like? Well, okay, so let's make new, fresh copies so that we can cut them open without destroying the old copies. So cut both of them open. I've just cut them open. Concatenate. And then close. So that's the pictorial version. Okay?
Sorry, just do we know that some knots don't have inverses? Or
we
is
definitely
it...
know that some knots don't have inverses.
Okay.
So in fact, no non-trivial knots have inverses.
Okay.
Okay? Right. But that's sort of a different class. Okay, so... Okay. Okay, so, well... So that's all I had to say about this space. In the abstract... well, actually, I have more, but it will come later. But, you know, at the moment, it's not even clear that it's non-empty. So it's only clear because I gave you a table of computations and the numbers seem to rise up to about to degree 12, okay? And it's also clear because we have actual finite type invariants, okay? But I want to show you that it's non-empty by intrinsic means, by looking at this space in itself somehow. Okay? And this is the next topic, and I'll have to tell you about Lie algebras and weight systems. And I think this is the first time that the word Lie algebra occurs out loud in this class. Maybe I'll start by a reminder about what's a Lie algebra. Do I need to start with a reminder about what's a Lie algebra? So very, very briefly, I think Lie groups are very intuitive. So Lie groups are continuous groups of symmetries. So for example, the group of rotations of a three-dimensional object, okay, the all ways of rotating a three-dimensional object is a continuous group of symmetries. Likewise, the group of rotations of an n-dimensional object, or so Lie groups occur everywhere. And then, if you have a Lie group, Well, you know, if you have a Lie group, it will be a manifold in which you have a multiplication structure. But in principle, if you have a Lie group and it is connected, then you can get from one to any other point in the group by going along a path. And then each step, going along each step of the path is moving along a tangent to the group. But it being a group, you can always translate these tangents to the origin. And then the moral is that if you fully understand the tangent space at the origin, you can understand the entire group. So I'm summarizing again, a full semester course into about two paragraphs, okay? But basically, if you want to understand a Lie group, it's enough and it's connected, then it's enough to understand its tangent space at the origin. The tangent space of the origin is a Lie algebra. So understanding Lie algebras is more or less the same as understanding all continuous symmetry groups you could have. Okay? So what's a Lie algebra? So you look at the tangent space of the origin, and it's clear that it has a linear structure. It's a vector space. So definition, a Lie algebra G is a vector space along, so linear structure is what makes it a vector space, along with, you look a little bit closer at the tangent space and you find that the conjugation operation in the group induces a binary operation on the tangent space. And again, I'm summarizing a whole semester course, so it's really just a reminder, okay? So, and the operation on the tangent space induced by conjugation is the following. So it's a bilinear bracket. So the bracket is denoted, well, it has sort of two inputs, and that's how it is denoted. It is a map from G tensor G into G. So this just means that it's bilinear, such that, it is anti-symmetric. So the bracket of any two elements, x and y, is the negative of their bracket in the reverse order. And two, Jacobi. Jacobi is the following identity, the bracket of x with y and z plus the two possible cyclic permutations of this is equal to zero. So plus the bracket of y with z and x plus the bracket of z with x and y, this whole sum is equal to zero. And again, this comes about because the identity because the operation induced by conjugations also always satisfies this. Okay. Examples. One, the abelian Lie algebras. Abelian Lie algebras. So, these correspond to abelian group. In an abelian group, conjugation is trivial, and that makes the bracket, in fact, trivial, but trivial in this context means zero. So the bracket of any two things is equal to zero, and quite clearly it satisfies both anti-symmetry trivially and the Jacobi identity trivially. Okay? By the way, you should have asked a vector space over which field, and the answer is, well, it makes sense over any field. For us, it will typically be the rationals. Okay. Example number two. Here is the simplest non-abelian Lie algebra. So take the field squared, and so this will be the Lie algebra, but I'll write it differently. I write it as the collection of all linear combinations ax plus by, where x and y are the two basis vectors, so I don't know, 1, 0, and 0, 1, if you wish. And and A and B belong to the ground field. Okay? So I've defined the vector space, I only need to tell you what the bracket is. So the bracket, well, in principle, I need to tell you the bracket of AX plus BY with CX plus DY. But by bilinearity, it's enough to take the bracket of a basis element with a basis element. So I need to give you four things. The bracket of x and x, the bracket of x and y, the bracket of y and x, and the bracket of y and y. But actually, the bracket of x with x, by antisymmetry, is the negative of the bracket of x and x, so it's equal to zero. Likewise for y and y. And if I know the bracket of x with y, I also know the bracket of y with x. So I only need to tell you what the bracket of x and y is. So I'll declare it to be x, and that fully defines the bracket. And then you can check that it actually satisfies the Jacobi identity. Okay? It takes a little bit of work, but not much work. By the way, this is the Lie algebra of the group of affine linear transformation. So this is the Lie algebra of the mx plus n group. So if you look at linear functions on the reals, then their compositions are again linear functions, and if you restrict to ones in which n is not equal to zero, then each one also has an inverse, and that's a Lie group, and that's its Lie algebra. More examples. So I said that every Lie group leads to a Lie algebra. Okay? But it's not the case. I mean, there are Lie algebras that don't come from Lie groups. For example, there are infinite dimensional Lie algebras. So here is example number three. The Lie algebra will be the free Lie algebra on some collection of generators, x, y, and z. Okay? So I don't think I want to define it and prove its properties in full, because, again, that takes an hour and it's not related to what we want to do. But at least loosely, you take, well, you basically assume that you have a vector space in which there are elements x, y, and z, and in which there is a bracket, and therefore there must be an element x bracket y. So this would be the vector space that has x, y, z, but then also the bracket of x and y. But you see, there also has to be the bracket of y and z. But there also has to be the bracket of y and x. Okay? But the bracket of y and x must be equal to the negative of the bracket of x and y. So basically, you write all possible expressions in the bracket, using the bracket in x, y, and z, and you identify any thing pair or triple of things that are should be equal to that have to be equal by the relations you have. It's going to be an infinite dimensional space, and it's not going to be the Lie algebra of any specific group. Okay. GLN, so GL of a vector space, GLN of a field F is the set of all, it's the set of all invertible, we're in Lie algebras. Sorry, so it's just the set of all n by n matrices. So it's the set of all n by n matrices with entries in the field with the operation that the bracket of two matrices is equal to, well, you multiply them in one order and then you multiply them in the other order. It's completely routine to check the Jacobi identity. Okay? And then there are lots of subgroups of this. So for example, SO N will be the group of the algebra of N by N matrices, so matrices in GLN such that the transpose of the matrix is equal to itself, negative of itself. Okay, and then there are lots and lots of examples below that. Okay, now this being the sort of a prime example, you want to see if you can map other examples into it. Okay? So that's what a representation of a Lie algebra will be. So first of all, definition, a morphism of Lie algebras is a linear map, R, going from one Lie algebra into another, which preserves the bracket. So the usual definition of a morphism in anywhere in algebra. So such that the bracket of R of X with R of Y is equal to R of the bracket of X and Y. Okay? And then definition a representation of G is a map, or you know what, I'm actually restricting my attention. Well, you know what? Well, no, I'm still restricting my attention to finite dimensional. So a finite dimensional representation of a Lie algebra G is a map, is a morphism of Lie algebras G goes to, I guess I'll call it R, G goes into GLN for some N. So, in other words, it's an assignment, X goes to, into a matrix R sub X, such that the matrix representing a bracket is equal to the bracket of the matrix representing X with the matrix representing Y. Okay? Okay. So, comments, questions? I've wasted your time, haven't I? I'm sorry. Okay. Anyway, we now have a theorem. So, well, it's not really a theorem, it's a construction, but it's a bit of a misnaming to call it a theorem. So, well, I'll misname it anyway. So, given any finite dimensional Lie algebra G, I should have added another piece of structure. A finite dimensional Lie algebra G so let me add here a finite dimensional metrized so I'll finish the statement of the theorem and then go back and define what metrized means. So given any finite dimensional Lie algebra G and a finite dimensional representation R of that Lie algebra, there exists a functional defined on core diagrams associated with this data. So there exists a map W sub G comma R going from A into the ground field. And when I say that it goes on A, that it is defined on A, what I mean is that it is defined on core diagrams, also with trivalent, internal trivalent vertices, it's the same, and satisfies all the relations. So in particular, this is a potential derivative of a not invariant. Okay? So, I mean, we still haven't proven the theorem that any potential derivative really is a derivative. But once this is proven, we will have a construction of a not invariant for any pair, finite dimensional Lie algebra and finite dimensional representation. Except, I forgot to tell you, except for two things. First of all, this is not a theorem, it's a construction. Okay? It will become a theorem only after I state what the construction is. And then the theorem will be that the construction is well defined and satisfies the relations. Okay? And second, I forgot to tell you what metrized is. So, definition. Metrized means has an invariant non-degenerate inner product. So I have to define what these things mean. So first of all, inner product, you know. Inner product is a map from a vector space tensor itself to the ground field. Right? So an inner product is something which I will denote with this bracket symbol, and it goes from G, tensor G, so it must be a binary function which is bilinear in its two arguments. And I suppose inside the definition of inner product is the fact that it is symmetric. So it should be symmetric, which means... what does symmetric mean? That the inner product of xy is equal to the inner product of y and x. Okay? Now I have to tell you what invariant means. So invariant means the definition will hardly make sense when I say it, but later, but then I will explain. So if you take the inner product of the bracket of z and x and y, it is equal, no, it's the negative of the inner product of x with the bracket of z and y. Okay? So the sum of these two is equal to zero. Okay? You know, I could spend some time telling you why this is the only reasonable thing you can write for Lie algebras. But rather, I will give you later, in a minute, an example, and then at least you will know that there are lots and lots of such things, or lots and lots of Lie algebras with such things on them. And then, finally, non-degenerate is the usual meaning of non-degenerate, meaning if x is not equal to zero, its bracket, there is some y, so that the bracket of x with y is non-zero. Or said differently, if for every y, the bracket of x and y is equal to zero, then x must be zero in itself. Okay? So, examples. So, for an abelian Lie algebra, so I'll just go over the examples we already have. So, for an abelian Lie algebra, if G is abelian, then this condition is empty, right? Because the bracket of anything with z is zero. So this is always satisfied. So the only condition is the non-degeneracy. So take any non-degenerate inner product and you're done. So take any non-degenerate inner product. Okay. Example number two, well, if you want a good exercise, there are no invariant inner product, no non-degenerate invariant inner products on that. So the story that we're telling is not about all the algebras, but only genuinely about the metrized one. So F2 has no metric. Three, the free Lie algebra, does it have a metric? Possibly, I'm not sure, but it's not finite dimensional, so it will not fit in our story anyway. So GLN is the one I really wanted to tell you about. So in GLN, define the inner product of two matrices to be the trace of their product. So, first of all, it's easy to show that it's non-degenerate. So, I will not show it, but if you take a matrix, basically, in fact, why is it non-degenerate? What should I, suppose you give me A, what B should I take to make this non-zero? So, let me tell you, so, non-degeneracy, so the trace of A times A transpose is equal to the sum squared of all elements, of all entries of A. So the only way this will be zero is if all the entries are zero. So for any matrix, non-trivial matrix A, we found something to evidence that it's non-zero. Okay. Oh, I should have said even before that, this is clearly bilinear, and the fact that it is symmetric is the fact that the trace of a times b is the trace of b times a. Is it sort of one of the interesting properties of trace. And finally, let's check this property. So let's compute the trace of, I guess I'll use the same language. So z x minus x z times y, and ask ourselves if this is equal to the trace of x times zy minus yz. Okay? So I'm checking non-degeneracy. So let's see. Zxy appears here.
So it's the negative.
The negative, you're right, sorry. Okay? I have to add these two things. So let's do that. So zxy appears on the left. There is no zxy on the right, but there is yzx, which is just a... well, it's zxy with the x moved to the beginning. So this term cancels that, and likewise this one cancels that, and so it's equal to zero. Okay? And finally, okay, the same inner product will also clearly work for any subset of GLN. For any subalgebra of GLN. So it also will also work for SON. And finally, this also works for SON, but in general, it also works for any Lie algebra that has a injective representation into GLN. Well, because then it's just a subset of GLN. Okay, so also for any Lie algebra with a faithful representation, so an injective representation with a faithful representation, so. If you've seen anything, if you've seen Lie algebras before, you'll know that there are plenty of examples. Okay? Is this okay?
Yes. When you restrict the inner product to a subalgebra, is it still non-degenerate?
Yes.
Because you only look at 0 for...
Yes, no, you are right. You are right that it requires a proof. So let me okay, since I don't have the proof ready, let me just say that with a faithful unitary representation. So basically the only property you really want is that So any subalgebra of GLN which is closed under taking the transpose, the same argument as here will hold. So at least for SON, this works because any element of S, I mean, SON is clearly closed under taking the transpose. You caught me.
But it's true, right? So that's
a I'm almost certain it is true, and I hope I'm not telling a lie.
Okay.
So I'm almost certain that it's true. But what is definitely true is that there are lots and lots and lots of interesting subalgebras that are closed under taking the transpose. So, yeah, you may have caught me on a mistake. Okay. Okay, so now we have all the ingredients, and I should tell you what the construction is. Yes?
I think that GLN may contain some abelian subalgebras. Abelian Lie subalgebras.
Yes.
It will know.
No, but
abelian Lie algebras do have a metric. Okay. Eva, can I erase this blackboard?
No, that's all right.
You know what? I'll erase this blackboard. So this, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't have done this review at all, but because now I hardly have time for the construction. So, you know what, I'll probably just have enough time to tell you that, okay, so we have a certain situation, okay? So we have G, we have a metric T, and we have a representation R. I want to say, and G is a finite dimensional. And the representation is also finite dimensional. So I want to say that this information is actually determined by finitely many constants. And I will only use these constants. Everything else sort of, well, will follow from these constants. So let me tell you what these constants are. So first of all, choose a basis x sub A running from 1 to the dimension of the Lie algebra of the Lie algebra. Second, choose a basis E sub alpha running from 1 to the dimension of R of the representation space. Okay, of the vector space in which you represent. Okay? And then you get a number of scales.